Good morning, everyone. We want to thank you for attending session 227, titled Mormon Mental Health Association, Living a Life of Paradox and Personal Growth. Before we begin, we ask that your cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session, following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation and at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books and consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. Also, as an added thing, the microphones are a little spotty in the back just throughout the session. If you in the back have difficulty hearing, just do like a thumbs up. They're going to be looking out for that to know whether or not they need to speak up a little bit more. And then this presentation will address the emergence of feminist consciousness and the experience of feminist women in a patriarchal religion. Within the context of human development, it will also address the challenges and personal growth arising from living a life of paradox. And presenters will speak in the following order. Verlin Christensen has a master's in social, an MSc, I'll just say that. Is a psychologist in private practice. She has written and conducted research on various topics including feminism, religion, relationships, and parenting. Natasha Helfer Parker, MSLCMFT, is a clinical member of the American Association of Marriage and Family Therapists and currently serving as president of the Kansas chapter, the American Association of Sexual Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, and the Mormon Mental Health Association, founder and current president. She runs the Mormon Therapist blog and the Mormon Mental Health podcast series. So they'll go ahead and turn the time over to the presenters, and we'll have a Q&A session afterwards.
Thank you, Sarah, for the introduction. As Sarah mentioned, my name is Verlin Christensen, and I am a psychologist practicing in County, Alberta. I'll give you a little bit more information about my background before I delve into my presentation. I was born in Belgium and spent most of my childhood and adolescence over there in Belgium. And during that time, I also lived in Burundi, a small country in Central East Africa, where I am originally from. My family moved to Canada from Belgium when I was about to start high school. My parents joined the LDS Church while they were living in Belgium, and at the time I was 2 years old, so I was pretty much raised in the church. I was also exposed a lot to the Catholic religion. All my extended family from both sides are Catholic. My parents were also were Catholic before they joined the church. So when I was growing up, I attended baptisms and first communions of cousins and friends. And also, while living in Belgium, the schools that I attended, my siblings also attended were Catholic. The school system in Belgium is such that the great majority of schools are Catholic. It was just the way it is. So a lot of people, regardless, a lot of students, regardless of their religious affiliations or lack of, would simply just attend a Catholic school. So during the week, we had our Catholic religion classes, and on special occasion, I would even attend special services at the Catholic church. And on Sunday, I would attend the LDS church with my family. When we moved to Burundi, things were a little bit different. There was no established LDS church, so for a couple of years, we would meet in a private room in our home and have sacrament meeting. Because there was no LDS church in Burundi, my father had been given a special permission to administer sacrament to his family on Sundays. So during that time, church consisted of a brief family meeting where we sang a hymn, shared a brief lesson, and had sacrament. And we made do with what we had. So we would use these old shot glasses that my parents had for sacrament water. And later on, when the church was introduced in Burundi, me and my parents believed in the Integral Party getting that started. Soon after, we moved back to Belgium for a few years, and then we moved to Calgary, Alberta, where my family has been since. Now, I don't know if you know a little bit about Calgary and Southern Alberta, but it's a very, very high LDS population. I like to call it the Utah of Canada, which is a lot of fun. Belgium and Burundi. So church became a lot more involved. In addition to church on Sundays, there were seminary activities every week, sometimes even on weekends. It was more than church on Sundays. It was a way of living. It was a way of doing things. It was a way of being. It was a culture indeed. For someone who has been raised with all of this and much more, it might not seem like a lot, but for me, it was quite overwhelming. I felt like my full participation and immersion into the culture determined my commitment to the faith. My sense of individuality felt quite suffocated. And the truth is, I felt more committed in places where I had to stand alone in my faith than I had been in trying to keep up with all these activities. So, the opportunity came up much later for me to be able to study the topic of woman, feminism. And when that opportunity came up, it just felt like all the stars had aligned themselves for me to just do that. It was a very empowering and very healing experience. It was a different time than we are in today in terms of woman feminism. There were just a few blogs and websites like By Common Consent and Dialogue. And I would probably say they were the most established. Feminist woman housewives were still in its beginnings, and the topic of feminism on that blog seemed to be addressed either in a very timid way or anonymously. Formal and academic research on woman feminism seemed also quite sparse, and there was also a huge gap in the literature that took place between the September 6th events in 1993 and the early 2000s. Now, based on this landscape, I was skeptical about finding participants who would openly be able to talk about modern feminism for my study. I was, however, surprised by the overwhelming reply. I had posted my notes on a few websites like By Common Consent, Dialogue, and The Feminist Woman Housewives, and the response was so overwhelming that I had to take down my notice after 24 hours. I was able to interview women from a wide age range who identified as feminists. Now, one of the first questions that I looked that I wanted to understand is, you know, how does a feminist consciousness develop? How do you come to define yourself as a feminist? I asked myself that question, but I also wanted to ask the participant that very question. And throughout my upbringing and various experiences that I had had, I always had a strong sense of being feminist. I did not always call it feminism, and that word came much later. I just remembered that from a very young age, being very fascinated by the stories of women who had gone beyond the cultural norm. I remember at that time the Prime Minister of Burundi, when I was a young kid and living in Burundi, the Prime Minister was a woman, and it was quite rare for that time, and also was quite rare in Africa to have a Prime Minister being a woman. And I remember whenever my father would turn on the news to watch the news, I would just sit beside him, and not because I was listening to the news, but just because I just saw there was a Prime Minister woman, and she has a position of power, and she has, you know, and she's being respected. So I just remember this from a very young age, finding that very, very fascinating. So one of the first questions that I explored doing my research on woman feminism was, you know, what was the emergence of your feminist consciousness? So I asked the woman that I interviewed to describe the various experiences that led to the feminist consciousness. And there are four themes that emerged. The first one is hearing covert messages throughout their upbringing. So hearing a lot of messages of the biased woman, that girls and women were naturally inclined to be meek, submissive, soft, and gentle, and that their primary responsibility was to take care of others. So basically hearing a very limited role of the woman. And also a lot of unspoken messages were also felt. So questions were asked, and it was experience in the educational and professional sphere. So among the participants that I interviewed, thank you.
Yes.
And please do remind me if I do wander off.
A little louder if you can too.
A little louder? Okay. So yes, recognizing discrepancies. So a lot of these women that I was interviewing were very highly educated and they were professionals. Some of them were lawyers, doctors, and they were treated in a particular way in their work setting, but they felt that they were treated a very different way within the church. Is the abuse of power. Now, although most of the participants experience subtle but clear messages, others had experiences with men who abuse their power to dominate and control, whether in a family or church setting. One woman referred to the term unrighteous dominion, which we've heard before, to differentiate between patriarchal men who just follow what had traditionally been done and those who purposely abuse their power to take advantage of women by controlling, manipulating, humiliating, and belittling them. The woman who experienced such abuse came to scorn and not lose respect for those who wielded such authority and power. Some of them came to associate such abuse with the patriarchal structure of the church. Now I want to say right here that it's not how the way all men operate in the church, but there was a subset of women and a subset of men who had abuse of that power. One last thing that emerged, and I very much do connect to that one, is the, in addition to the other three that I've mentioned, it's also the feminist consciousness did not develop from their experience in church, but rather it was through the culture in which they were brought in. There are a couple of participants that I interviewed that have been brought up in a non-Caucasian culture, but a non-Caucasian culture that was patriarchal. My experience was very similar to those women, as I mentioned, and my first experience with patriarchal for me was also when I was living in Burundi. Having lived in Belgium before, it became very apparent to me that girls and women had a very prescribed role in domestic matters. On the one hand, Burundi was one of the rare countries at that time in Africa, if not maybe even the only one, to have a woman prime minister in power. I believe there were also many women in the government. But on the other hand, in my everyday life, I would hear messages such as, you know, you should never let a man go in the kitchen, or that you should wait until the man has served himself before getting your food. And this is just to name a few examples. And I was reminded of that role when I went back to Burundi with my husband in 2005. We had a big family dinner, and there were lots of tables. And I had barely finished my meal when one of my aunts came and whispered in my ear to say that, you know, in our culture, meaning in the Burundian culture, that I should be getting up and helping clear the plates of the men around my table. And just to give you an idea, at that time, the men around my table were my husband and my brother, who's one of them, was 10 years old, and my cousins, who were not much older than my brother. So I looked around and I guess things have not changed. But anyhow, I just nodded to my aunt just to let her know that I heard, and then I turned to, you know, to she said it quietly enough that none of the other people on the table had heard it. But I remember just turning to them and just telling them, this is what my aunt just told me right now. So I'm going to ask all of you guys to just get up and just clear your own plates. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll do it. Such domestic roles in Burundi specifically, you know, they had really advanced education. Was my aunt, you know, great career, very educated, but when it came to these domestic matters, you know, she really very much still took a very traditional place. So the rise of feminist consciousness was not necessarily a moment in time, but rather a combination of various things that the participant and myself also would see, and it would just kind of just go, you know, they would start to think, well, you know, maybe something is not quite right over here. Something is not quite fitting. Another thing that I really wanted to explore when I was doing my research was what was the experience of these women? Like, what is your experience as a woman feminist in a patriarchal religion? What is your experience? And again, there are three major things that arose from there. I'll quickly go over those. The first one was a strong disparity in favor of men. So they would see that there were roles assigned to men based on sex only. One participant I remember saying, you know, it's not like in my job where if I work harder, maybe I can get to that point. It doesn't matter what I do, there's no option for me to be able to ever get to a particular place. So just kind of feeling that there was just something that's just not even an option, simply just not an option. The whole message that they're equal, but men preside, and also that men are experts of all, even a woman. I remember there was a belief society state president that I had, that was one of the participants, and she had expressed the frustration that she was trying to order something. She was in Canada trying to order something from Salt Lake, and she was basically told over the phone that she needed to get the permission of the state president to be able to order the books. But you know, it's a small example. Maybe even by saying like a petty one, but it's just, it goes to show though that everything has to go through a man. The second thing was that a lot of these women felt that there was a strong upholding of tradition that was done mainly through rationalization. So just justifying things like patriarchy and polygamy, lack of the priesthood, and just finding explanation that really didn't have any standings. Patronization as well as socialization were ways also that these women felt that the traditions were being upheld. And by socialization, I mean being socialized from a very young age to just accept some of these assumptions. The last thing that emerged right here in terms of the experience of women within the patriarchal religion is just simply there, how they felt within their experience and how they felt within the patriarchal religion. So basically, again, the definition of a very narrow definition of woman and the role of woman, so very centered on motherhood and domestic roles. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just, I can do more than that, was very much the message. Or what if I cannot do that, and what if I do something else, is that maybe not, where is my place, where is my place in this community? A lack of equal opportunity, and also not feeling listened to or taken seriously. And feeling also a frustration that not enough women were asserting themselves. A lot of these women would go to other women to be able to express some of the things that they were feeling, but they find very much that other women were not necessarily listening to them or even understood them. So you think of the women or the sisterhood, and it wasn't there. Sometimes they were better understood by their father than they were by the woman in their lives. So after gathered many questions and gathered many themes, and I'm not going to go into all of them. We'll be here for quite a long time. But after gathering many of the stories and studying the emerging themes, the process of individuation played a very essential role in being able to understand the experience of woman, feminist woman. And after that, again, it was a process of individuation. The origins of the process of individuation can be linked to Heinz Warner. Heinz Warner addressed the orthogenetic principle, which is a theory of human development, which basically states that development always proceeds from a condition characterized by a lack of differentiation to a condition that shows increasing differentiation and integration. So in other words, everything starts with fusion. principle to human development, but its origin actually from a biological perspective. For example, you have an egg and a sperm that comes together, which is a fusion process, to create a cell that will divide and divide, the separation process, until it becomes an entity of its own, a new being separate from the matter. Now, this principle of individuation has been mentioned many times by various professionals and has been used in psychology. There's nothing new about this. And it has been applied within child psychology, adolescent, as well as adult development. And the purpose of human development, I truly believe, is really to define our own self and to define our own path. And that path might be different from the one that we were taught. Werner says, though, that although they might differ, they also originate from the same source. The new being that emerged will be different from the mother, from its source, but there will also always be that connection. The process of individuation or separation is by nature a lonely passage. We are leaving what we know to create something new. It is a process that is lonely and can cause some anxiety, not because there is something wrong with that process, but simply because it is supposed to be such. So the moment feminists or liberals that I interview at first and since then that I have worked with in my practice are often undergoing some form of a process of individuation. The process of defining their own sense of self, different from what they have known. It is often a process where they come more to themselves, and this process is not an easy one. I call my thesis Creating Space to specifically address the emergent self that results from this process, and how a new space needs to be created in order to make room for the emergent self. Now, a lot of the common challenges that comes with this process of individuation, feeling very alone, feeling very misunderstood and frustrated, but also believe that there is personal growth, and that the participants are going through a process of differentiating themselves from the environment they were brought in. And they are defining their own path, and I believe it is a very essential process to healthy human development. Now, how should we approach our own individuation? If this is where we are at in our life, how do we approach that, especially with some of the difficulties that I have mentioned that comes with that? I have found a few things quite helpful actually in my work as a psychologist, and I believe that these can be applied into better understanding the process in terms of where we are at, in terms of our process of individuation. And I want to kind of clarify right here, this process of individuation does not necessarily have to happen only within a religious context. It can happen within various contexts, at various levels, at various stages in our life. So it could be adolescence, it could be adulthood, it could be within a setting of religion, it could be within the setting of a political setting, it could be, but it's just this whole process of I'm different than what I have. I've been brought up with, and being able to define that for your own self. So this understanding of human development, how should we approach our own individuation? I think that the goal is not to fix and relieve the tension that is created, but rather to hold the space and let it unfold what needs to unfold. If this is truly a process of individuation, we cannot just say, oh well, you know, we want things to turn out a particular way. I think we need to just leave a space for things to unfold and just see what's this new being that is going to unfold from this experience. For some, individuation I need to leave, or just for some, individuation I need to leave or stay or anything in between. I don't think there's any need to define it. We feel like sometimes we need to define it. Well, does that mean I'm going to leave? Does that mean I'm going to stay? Sometimes we just need to leave the room for things to happen. I find that during that time, a lot of the participants that I interviewed and also some of the clients that I have worked with since then, they have found it very helpful to be able to construct their own meaning of not only their journey, but also of a lot of the theological concepts that they have learned. So basically seeing feminism as the core of modern theology, focus on the heavenly other, and being able to find a definition of this is how I understand my religion. It might not quite be accepted by the mainstream religion, but this is being able to just create their own understanding in and of itself can be also very, very empowering and very helpful. For me, meeting and speaking with other women who had similar experiences was very empowering. So that sense of connecting with other women who are having similar experiences can be very powerful. I made it a point, I remember when I was receiving all these emails, I said, well, there's no way that I can truly connect with these women and be able to conduct this research over the phone. Skype was not even that well developed. It was quite choppy still back then. And I just wanted to really have that true connection. So I traveled. I went to 6 different cities, 3 in Canada and 3 here in the U.S. and interviewed women personally and went to their homes. I felt that connection. I don't think I would have been able to really get the information that I had, that I received, if I had not really been able to truly connect with each one of these women. But so yes, that connection is very important, whether it is virtual or whether it is one-on-one. Now, as mentioned earlier, the process of individuation can be isolating, even with the support of family and friends. I believe it is important to normalize those hard feelings and to see them as not a failing, but rather a passage. If not understood well, it can be experienced as deep emotions of hurt, depression, and anxiety. I think that in the midst of, and we do get to that point of hurt, depression, and anxiety, especially if we have attached ourselves and we're trying to create something new. But if we give our experience purpose, the purpose is that I am individuating, there's more, it's not just, I'm just going through all these feelings and I don't know what they mean. There's purpose to the experience. The process of individuation is also not linear. It is about your personal balance, which can change based on the environment and current needs. I remember that when Gloria Steinem got married in 2000, a lot of people criticized her because they felt that she was just going back on the words and just saying she had mentioned earlier that she would never get married. And I really liked her answer. She said, well, I did not change. I'm still the same woman. It's not me who changed. The institution of marriage has changed, and therefore I feel more comfortable getting married now. So, again, the environment might change. Our current needs might change. It's not linear. It's just, let's just leave it to whatever needs to happen. Sometimes we come from a culture of certainty, and sometimes we feel like if we're not there, we'd better be there. But it does not have to be that way. This process of individuation can be complicated even more when it causes tension within a relationship and family, especially if the individuation brings a person to a place that makes close ones uncomfortable. And I have found that one personally the most difficult to deal with in my practice. But I do want to, I wasn't planning on talking about it, but I do want to just very quickly mention a couple of points about that, and then open it up for questions. Some of the things that I have seen, I'd like to specifically actually focus on couples and family. I feel like I've focused quite a bit on the individual, but I'd like to focus just really quickly on couples and families. Now, some of the challenges that I have seen coming up is, and this can be within, just think of it within a couple, within a family, creates a lot of uncertainty about the future. Now, all of a sudden, everything was lined up, everything was very straightforward in terms of what would happen next, and then now it's like, well, what are we going to do next? And this is specifically both members, both the spouse, or the whole family is involved within the LDS culture. Depending on where your partner is at, or your family is at, you can feel also very misunderstood. There's potential for a lot of tension and a lot of hurt. You might also be perceived by your partner and your family. Your process of individuation might be perceived by your partner and family a change in values rather than enforce a system of integration. And differentiate the two, I think, is very, very important. People think that you lose all your ethics and you lose all your values and that you have nothing. But what if you have something good, something different to create? It's different. It's not bad. It's just simply different. I find a good thing within a marriage. There's a lot of confusion between strength of faith and strength of marriage. Not being able to differentiate between those two. The marriage is very much focused on the faith. And if we don't have the faith, then what do we have? So it really pushes people to define their marriage beyond just the religious setting. And that can be quite challenging sometimes. And another one that I found very challenging also is the impact on children, whether they are young children or adult children. And what I will say about that, there are so many different scenarios that I have seen, but what I will say about that, well, I'll say two things. The first thing is that if the parents are able to figure things out between themselves, usually, most of the time, the rest of the family, the children, will be able to understand. But it also very much depends on how the children have been brought up. If they've been brought up and this is how things have to go, and this is the step, this is the road that you're supposed to follow, and all of a sudden the parents are no longer following that path, it can create quite a bit of tension. And sometimes even I'm not as far discussing with couples the possibility of a multi-faith marriage. Now, each step of the individuation process has a purpose. The first step is focused on attachment. As I mentioned, attachment to the extended family, attachment to the community. In this case that I'm speaking, attachment to the religion. And such attachment may have limited offering. But in return, it also offered us a much needed sense of belonging. I do not want to downplay the first stage of this individuation process, which is fusion. It is important, as I mentioned before, successful fusion is important in order for separation to happen. And also it's provided a much needed sense of belonging. We need to have that sense of belonging before we can decide, well, we do want that, or no, we do not want that. And then, you know, next comes again the process of separation. But that process of separation, when it does come, it does threaten the social order we have come to rely on and create what might seem like a sense of chaos. But this loss of control does not have to be seen in a negative light. We need to also be open to the idea that letting go can actually be both emotionally and spiritually freeing. So I'd like to open it up to questions at this point. But first of all, I'd like to turn it to Natasha, and we'll go from there.
Okay, well, I just presented a bit of a response. Can you hear me? Because this is kind of a lower microphone, but I'm a little bit louder probably. Everybody can hear me okay? Okay. So it's interesting that Galen and I share a very similar background. My parents were also converts to the church in a country where it was just starting. It was in Spain, right after, well, during actually the dictatorship of Tulab.
No.
Oh, okay. Of Franco, I think that was his name. Anyway, so the church was just starting in Spain, and we had similar situations where sacrament meetings were in our home, and mission president with a lot of blind children showed up, and I was 6 and fascinated. So anyway, and what I understood is that we've done a really good job of whitewashing the missionary message from its patriarchal and feminist issues. It was 10 years later that my mother found out about polygamy when we had moved back to the United States, and I had no idea, and I think it was quite a shock, and obviously faith crisis for her. And we many of us joined the church in a very safe space of exploration and growth, and my mother also came from a Catholic background that she felt was quite punitive and also gendered issued, and all of a sudden finding out that what she had converted to had its own, I guess, brand of that. just say, oh, this is no longer for me. So you try to make it fit. This is kind of a classic example of cognitive dissonance. And because, you know, there's aspects of it that are very dear to you, and you don't want these new aspects to kind of ruin the whole tomato, if that makes sense. So these, I think, are situations that a lot of members are in, and I think especially members who haven't necessarily grown up in the LDS culture. But it happens also, I find, with many of you who come from pioneer heritage and just had no idea about your heritage. And so that's another aspect of what we're dealing with. So my work with the Mormon Mental Health Association, and Berlin is a part of that, is in our goals, is that when we're looking at these kinds of issues from a clinical perspective, I hear a lot of stories that are problematic. So in other words, you go to the non-LDS therapist, which might be actually a very good therapist, but not really understanding the, or having the cultural confidence to deal with what these implications really mean. So if you say, well, you know, I really don't agree with my church on this or that, and it's very typical that a therapist might say, well, if it's not working for you, that's okay, you know, and you don't have to go anymore, and have you thought about that possibility? And that's not a very culturally competent way to deal with Mormons, especially the leading active ones. And so, and it's not that that's an incorrect way to think, but it just really does not understand the complexity of what a religion that's as involved as Mormonism is about. And then you have the other example of LDS therapists who may not be, and this isn't all of them, but some LDS therapists have a hard time differentiating between their own personal testimonies and relationship with the church and their clients. And so when you have somebody questioning the church or its positions, the normal anxieties rise, and depending on how ethically based that therapist might be, is how well they can control that or not. And specifically, if they're working for an organization with LDS Family Services, even if they're pretty good at that, they may feel limited at what they can or cannot explore with their client, just due to what their bosses are telling them they can or cannot explore. Does that make sense? So these are some of the issues that we have clinically as you're dealing with these things. And I think that what Verlaine's research is so important about pointing out is that this is big stuff. And I think I think a lot of people are like, well, you're just changing your beliefs. So what? You know, or that's not a big deal. This is a big deal. And it affects your social construct. It affects your mental health. It affects your family relationships. I mean, it can have huge implications. And again, depending on the type of family background you come from, you know, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Christy Money and have maybe listened to some of her podcasts, but, you know, we've got basically a family shunning going on. You know, and with no discipline from the church for that. A family shunning. Christy Money. So those are real, where you have other people like maybe John Belands, who his mom is like hugging him and pictures with him, and you know, even though I believe she's still active in the church, it's not as big of a family issue. Does that make sense? There's not that. So there's a huge spectrum in our shared experience as to what may or may not be happening in our families and in our wards and our geographical regions and where we live. I know I've lived in the Ann Arbor ward. That's very different from the Wichita ward I currently live in. So, you know, these are very different types of things that just happen, and we're all kind of stuck in these different realms. So I think what I would like to just get maybe the question started from Maureen is, because I think she's done a good job of explaining why walking the middle way, or for those who are feminist, trying to stay active in church, it comes at a great cost. I'd like to shift a little bit of a question to those that I have found the people who seem to be most vitriolic in the feminist movement are other women who are practicing LDS women. And again, this is not, LDS women are wonderful, whether they're believing or unbelieving, but this anxiety, I think, causes a great amount of not knowing how to manage your own differentiation. And it was interesting, your example about your aunt, who I think that shows kind of a similar thing. You're so invested in the culture, you've spent so much of your life invested in that, you've made so many of your decisions based on what this culture tells you is allowed for your life, that then to shift that is extremely risky and dangerous and causes a great deal of anxiety. And so it's not that I want to say, oh, these women are vitriolic, how dare they? I think there's really good reasons for them to be vitriolic about it, and how do we increase our empathy and understanding about that process, especially if we're on the other side of that. I mean, I just received some Facebook messages today because I took a picture with Lisa Patterson, Lisa from this Mormon Housewives, and, you know, why are you guys separating yourselves from the rest of us? You know, those things. I'm like, oh my goodness, I just took a picture and I'm having fun. But okay. So I guess I would like to ask you your thoughts about this idea about economic cause, the dynamic of women believing or being so invested that it's difficult to make that shift, and then when that wall finally breaks for many of them, you know, what your thoughts are about why men actually tend to be more feminist friendly nurturers than women.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Natasha, for that question. When I was doing my research, it doesn't matter whether I was studying woman feminism or just feminism in general, there was actually a history of, and I think one of the authors, I can't remember her name, said it really well. It was, she said ladies against women. And basically she was saying that there has been a history of women being particularly against the feminist movement. As early as, you know, the suffragists to even today have a seat in our culture. There is, I think, a sense of safety in the way that we have defined, the role of women has been defined, and all of a sudden that changes. And there seems to be more of a reluctance sometimes from women than there might be for men. Now, I don't have any particular statistics to say whether more men or more women are supportive, but there seems to be a stronger push for women to say, you know what, no, go back to you know, where we're at in terms of where we're at. So it's a history. Where it comes from exactly, I'm not quite sure. Why my aunt, who's very well educated, has a very egalitarian relationship with her husband, and who is who's a doctor, is pushing so much to have that, to pushing so much that very domestic role of a woman. I guess the cost of her not doing that too is quite high, the way she would be perceived within her cultural, the way she would be perceived within the Burundian culture. So a lot of interesting dynamics, I think, that certainly include fear, the image, and just taking somebody's role away. If you're taking their role away within the home, what else am I left with? And sometimes it's working for them, so why should we change it? I'm not sure if I've answered your question, but yes.
Yeah, no, I think those are really good points. And I have come across some research that shares that oftentimes oppressed people, a few of the oppressed will start the change, but they'll actually have more resistance from their own oppressed culture than they will from other aspects of people who will ally with them. So it's just an interesting dynamic, but I do think it has to do with that idea of economic cost. Like, I've already had to figure out how to fit into the system, and that's taken a lot of work. And so to change that takes a lot more work. And like you said, there's a lot of loneliness and depression and things that are hard to go through if you're going to engage in that type of process. So it's natural to be averse to that.
Yes,
okay, so we're going to go ahead and open it up for questions. Anybody has? Yes.
I'm looking at it because I wrote an op-ed a few weeks ago about the risk of hormonal monitoring. As I was surveying, in those forms, you know, what were the things that concern progressive Mormons? I mean, I know progressive Mormons means a lot of things, but the issue of gender equality was definitely first in the topic, but also, I mean, of course I just do the 10 most, you know, repetitive things, but one thing that someone suggested too that
end of the day, I think we need to protect our own well-being. And how do we change that? How do we change that on such a in such a strong community? Maybe I think that a lot of the efforts, a lot of the things that have come even in the last 5 years in terms of women feminism, I think it has, we still have a long ways to go, but it has done a lot. In terms of the individual, I think that sometimes you do need to take care of yourself, and you need to protect yourself and your loved ones before. Because until you get to that place, I think that then you have the strength to go out there and make the difference that needs to be made. Natasha, for something.
Well, it is extremely difficult because you can be the strongest woman around and still be very much caught up in a system that's set up to not give you the power to speak or the power to complain. Because the way it's set up now, it's so patriarchal. The state presidents usually want to support their bishops, so even if you go complain to the state president, it's very often that they're going to back the bishop. And then if you write a letter, it's getting sent back to the state president. I mean, there's no like real accountability, which I think is what you're mentioning by a hotline. I see this as obviously a big role of the Mormon Mental Health Association, and part of what we are wanting to do is come up with position statements that will help empower individuals and ecclesiastical leaders, and by that I mean religious society presidents and all kinds of, young women's, young men's presidents. And we just came up with one that we responded to the letter that the church came out with after SCOTUS decision, and we are like 2 seconds away from coming out with one about reparative therapy and our thoughts about that. And we're going to also be coming up with one about sex addiction and the inappropriateness of those labels and how to deal with sexual problematic behavior in ways that are less pathologizing, because they do exist, but the way via rhetoric around it is really hurting both males and females on those ways. So, of course, I'm a sex therapist, so my board keeps reminding me we don't need to always come up with sex positions. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay, right, substance abuse, yeah, okay, good. But, this masturbation thing is dear to my heart. That's a position that I've personally gone to bat for and paid the price for. And we'll continue to do so, because I think that not only is it sexual harassment, I think it's sexual abuse of our minors. And I think that putting a child or a minor, adolescent, in a room with a bishop who's asking those types of questions is absolutely inappropriate.
This is what we need in religious society. We need instruction for the women. We need
movements like ours taking a more direct role and being faster, quicker about things.
Thank you both for your work and research. I have two children that are just starting to get a little older. My wife and I are both feminists and try to keep the socialization, but we're really, really, really worried as our children get older that they're going to absorb patriarchy from our faith and church service. Is there anything we can do to prevent that from happening? Any tricks or tips?
Something is said within church or within a sacrament meeting, and you're aware of that as a parent. The main teacher is not the church, the main teacher are the parents. And they are going to hear these messages, just like they're going to hear outside messages, at school or whatever environment. And I think that we have the influence as parents to be able to say, this is what you heard, let's discuss this, and flush it out. This is not actually how the world operates. So if you hear your friends talking about drugs at school, this is actually what, like, I think we have a lot of influence as parents to be able to just, to say to our children that, those messages that you heard are not what we aspire to, or we feel that they are harmful, and children do listen. When parents do not have a conversation with their children, sometimes we let a little bit of the raising of our children into the hands of the church, and it's really easy to kind of just stand back and just let the church teach our children. I think we have fallen into that quite a lot in the church. So when we have to take that role, we kind of go, actually have to take that role as a parent and actually do some work and actually have those discussions. It's hard, and I think it's not something we're used to as LDS parents. But having that conversation, I've had a lot of adolescents where I go, they come to me and they say, this was said at church. And they automatically assume that because it was said at church and their parents were sitting right beside them, they didn't flinch, they didn't, nothing happened. They're like, well, whatever was said before you, obviously my parents must be agreeing with it. And obviously, but I don't agree with this. What do I think to all that? So it's important to have that conversation about what is being said in the podium. And correct in some of those things.
One thing that I will say from the substance abuse research that we know is that kids really do follow parents more than peers. Now, not for a time, so from about probably 14 to 19, not so much. And that's when, of course, our parental anxiety goes a little weedy. But it's okay, because we know that by their mid to late 20s, they're really usually mimicking parents. So if you're presenting these kinds of ideas, it's great. And kids will have a natural tendency to rebel against parents anyway, and that's part of their developmental cycle. What greater way for them to rebel than to get more traditional on you? I mean, that's better than cocaine. So it's like the church, in a sense, offers that, whether it's you're wearing a pink shirt because you're rebelling, or now you're wearing a white shirt, and my brother rebelled by going on a mission. So that was, not the worst way he could have rebelled. And so it's just understanding that those dynamics will happen. But I do think that parents play an incredibly big role. The strategy that I have used is we come home from church, and I really try, because, I have my issues with my own anger management around certain things, and so I don't want to necessarily project all of that on my kids. And so I really ask both questions. Was there anything at church today that you heard that bothered you or that you did not agree with? And then the second question is, was there anything at church today that you liked, where you felt the spirit, where you felt like, wow, that really kind of edified me or made me feel good? And those two questions have driven our entire Sunday dinner discussions. And it's beautiful to hear what my kids have to say.
Okay, we're actually out of time. So if you have questions, you can kind of find them probably around the halls in the breaks. But I want to thank Natasha for that presentation.